Good morning. Thank you for joining KBOO 90.7 in Portland, 91.9 in Hood River, and 100.7 in the Valley. KBOO.fm if you're listening via the net. And this is More Talk Radio. Today is Monday, October 11th, 2010, and my name is Cecil Prescott. We thank you for joining us this morning, and we have a great program. Many of us are confused and are wondering, what is the economy all about? For several weeks, we've had several discussions on the radio with you, our listeners, about the economy. And we have joining us with us someone who can help us understand what is happening, what should happen, and help us sort through some of the difficult things that we are facing these days. Joining us today is Dr. Martin Hart Landsberg, who is a professor of economics and director of political economy program at Lewis and Clark College here in Portland, Oregon. His areas of teaching and research include the political economy, economic development, international economy, and the political economy of East Asia. Dr. Hart Landsberg is not only a professor, but an activist in the local community, having been a valuable member of the Workers' Rights Board here in Portland, Oregon. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here with you.
It's so great to have you. And before we went on air, you mentioned that you just returning from a sabbatical, so you're well rested, I hope.
I think so.
Okay, great. So, you know, there's so much that's happening in the economy now and so much that is confusing. And one thing that we thought would be helpful for you is to help us unravel what we're hearing and how to understand what's going on. So when I pick up the newspaper and I see that there was a stimulus plan, whether it's working or not, depending on which political commentator you're hearing different things. Maybe as a beginning, what is helpful to know about how to discern and how to read the newspaper to understand about the economy?
Well, that's a great starting question and a huge one. I mean, I guess the first thing to say is that most of the way our choices are presented to us or the policies presented to us are not helpful at all. The thing to say is we're in a real struggle in terms of what kind of economy we should have, and that there are very powerful interests who want to maintain the given structure. And they don't want to open up any conversations about whether this structure is fundamentally flawed. And so for me, I guess the starting point is to realize that the financial crisis that everyone talks about is sort of the end result of a serious problem in the U.S. economy. For example, going back to the 1970s, when Germany gets rebuilt, Japan gets rebuilt, Korea, some of the other Asian countries start to be producing things, U.S. companies start to suffer declining profits. Mm-hmm. And they don't like these profits being declined. And so one of the things they do is they turn to try and force workers to take lower wages, and workers resist. And there's kind of the standoff until the early 1980s. Ronald Reagan gets elected, and the government joins with companies and seeks to sort of weaken labor, smash unions, roll back social programs, an aggressive foreign policy, sort of recreate an environment for U.S. businesses to make lots of money. But the context of doing this, of destroying workers and purchasing power, throws the U.S. economy into a recession. Workers don't have much money. To try and sustain themselves, they start to borrow money. This is a period of credit card debt. Mm-hmm. Workers start to do this. The U.S. economy, under the conditions of this recession and low wages, businesses don't really invest in rebuilding their plant and equipment, but they find that lots of people throughout the world want to invest in U.S. financial assets. So U.S. business begins to make a decision. Instead of fighting Japanese companies and German companies by building in the U.S., let's shift production out and let's begin to build finance. And so we get all this money starting to come into the stock and bond market. And so beginning in the 1980s and then on, we begin to get a shift to the U.S. economy. So for example, where financial profits were about 4%, 5% of total profits in 1980, by 2007, they're 40% of profits. Mm-hmm. Now, this process in the 80s didn't really produce a lot of growth. It kept profits up, but the economy didn't function well. There was another recession in the late 80s. There was a recession in the early 90s. And what began to generate growth, finally, in the United States was when the U.S. government drove down interest rates very low. There was this big high-tech euphoria. Everyone's going to the internets, and, you know. And so it started a stock market bubble. Stocks went shooting way, way up. And people at the top were making lots of money. And this bubble sort of drove growth in the late 90s. And so suddenly everyone said, oh, the U.S. economy is wonderful. This was a bubble. And the reason why I say it's a bubble is that actual profits started to fall in 1997. Stock market kept growing all the way till 2000, when finally people realized that the economy itself, underlying economy, wasn't functioning well. So there was a collapse. We come out of the recession, 2001, the government again lowers interest rates, and we move into a housing bubble. And the reason I go through all this history is to say that even with the stock market bubble of the late 1990s and the housing bubble of the 2000s, the U.S. economy had one of its worst overall economic performances. Average income actually declined. Investment in real factories and machinery was stagnant. The only thing that grew was profits. And the only reason those profits grew was because of this speculation. And why this is important is to say that if we finally bring this speculation down, if we actually keep the banks from speculating, if we actually force some rules in terms of financial shenanigans, we're left with an economy that was stagnant. That stagnation existed through the 80s and through most of the 90s until these bubbles came along. So the problem is, when we talk about reform of the banking system, or we talk about, you know, opening the books on finance, we're not really dealing with the substantial problems of the U.S. economy. And those problems can be seen in all the long-term trends. After each recession that we've had since the 70s, it's taken more time for the economy to regain the number of jobs it had before the recession started. So let me give you an example. So the recessions in the 70s and 80s, it took 10 months for the economy to generate the number of jobs we had before the recession started. For the recessions in the 90s, it took 23 months. For the recession in 2001, it took 39 months. For this recession, people are saying it might take 60 to 70 months just to get back to the number of jobs we had when the recession started. These are structural problems.
Wow. We're speaking this morning with Dr. Martin Hart Landsberg, professor of economics at Lewis and Clark College, and we're having a very good conversation about the nature of our economy and how to understand it and how to sort through the political rhetoric we hear. Continuing our conversation with Dr. Hart Landsberg, professor of economics at Lewis and Clark College here in Portland, Oregon. A primer in terms of understanding our economy and what we can do about it. I wanted to go back to something you began with in terms of the shift in our economy. I'm coming out of World War II, and then you said there was a shift, a decision to not invest in, I guess, manufacturing, but in financial assets. What is that? Is that something I can hold or build? It's not a car or...
No. I mean, finance can play a helpful role in any economy. People have to borrow money. You want to buy houses. Businesses want to borrow money. But when finance takes off, it's making money off of money. So, for example, General Motors started making more money from its finance arm than from buying and selling cars. You know, Target and Walmart start making 20 to 25% of their money from credit cards and loans. More money instead of, when businesses make money, the question is where they put their money. Do they build new buildings? Do they invest in new machinery? Or do they put it into other financial businesses that will buy and sell stocks and derivatives and speculate on currency movements? And so what happens is that more and more of the country's resources flow into activities that are just manipulating money. And you can make money on that for a while. But if the underlying economic forces are not secure and not sound, then all that money on top of money will eventually collapse. So it's not to say that finance itself is unnecessary or bad, but what happened is, just to go back to what you were saying, is that at some point over the 80s and 90s, businesses made individual and then collective decisions that their emphasis on making money was going to be easier to make money in financial activities than in fact investing in the United States, maintaining what we would consider for us a healthy U.S. economy. This wasn't an accident. It was a structural decision. It was a decision generated by profits. And I guess this is one of the key things, is that, you know, we have a president, Obama, who says, as all the past presidents, you know, when we came to the crisis and we said, I mean, my analysis being that this is sort of a structural crisis, and it's a crisis because we've had too much emphasis on finance, too much supporting profits from low wages, you know, a lack of investment. What did Obama say? He said, well, we have a terrible banking system, but instead of saying, let's take it over, let's shrink it and reorient the money to real uses, he said, well, we've got to keep it in private hands. Mm-hmm. Auto industry, instead of saying we need an industrial policy, a green policy, so we're going to take over this industry that's failing and direct the resources into areas we need, he said, no, we've got to keep it in private hands. Healthcare. Again and again, we have to let the market work. We have to let private work. We have to harness the profit motive. And the fact is that letting the market work, letting profit motive guide our economic decisions, has led to an economy that's imbalanced, that's based on exploiting workers, that's unstable. But it's a system that does benefit a very small elite group of people, and they're not going to give that up. And so part of the problem is, when we had this crisis and people instinctively said, wow, you know, the system has failed, we need to step in and start to plan it, start to mm-hmm. think, what is the economy for? And what capacities do we need to plan and redirect money? They were met with this argument, no, impossible. Yes. We have to let the market go. And so that's what happened. And in fact, the stimulus did help in terms of keeping the economy from collapsing, but the stimulus was very carefully structured. So you had extra money for unemployment, good. Extra money for state and local, good. Massive amounts of money to bail out the banks and things, but very little money or commitment to actually restructuring the economy. What we did was try and bail out the existing economy. Mm-hmm. We propped up the major banks. We sustained the existing auto companies. And at the same time, we continued to negotiate free trade agreements. At the same time, we refused to change labor law to make it easier for workers. And so essentially, we've been drifting, having stopped the collapse, but left with an economy that no longer has bubbles, but is now fully experiencing the stagnation that was coming along before the bubbles. Mm-hmm. And so to the extent that we hear of policies that don't really tackle, don't really give us the understanding that it's markets that are failing, that the drive for private profit that's the problem, that what we need to do is build capacity to reshape our economic activity, we're not going to be moving ahead.
And yet, at the same time, we hear opposition to even the discussion or the possibility of even raising that issue in terms of even, I think, related to the rise in the Tea Party movement, where the criticism isn't that the president isn't doing enough to change the economy, yeah. but that he's doing too much yeah. to hold back.
Well, it's true. And I think one of the key problems is that while a lot of people understand that there's a serious problem and want change, I don't think I think individually it's difficult to conceive of how to make this change. So people then say, well, individually, what can I do except try and get lower taxes? Or what can I do is see if I can find my way through the system. And so the problem is that without strong unions, without strong community groups, without consistent and clear sources of information and news, we don't have the confidence, we don't have the collective strength to make demands. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the critical tasks. And of course, I think one of the critical strengths of KBOO, we need community institutions like KBOO. And we need to think about how, instead of you know, how we build our unions and our community groups and our communities of faith into places where people can come together, understand things, develop trust, and develop a concrete analysis of the kind of changes that we need to make so we can begin to put an alternative vision on the political agenda.
We're continuing our conversation with Dr. Martin Hart Landsberg, professor of economics at Lewis and Clark College. Before we took that short break, Dr. Hart Landsberg was explaining to us in terms of how to look at the foundation of our economics and the real issues. Continuing that conversation as we discern where we are as a nation, as an economy, several things come up that we should get to before maybe we open up our phone lines. Another issue that is very confusing right now is in terms of Social Security. Oftentimes we hear that Social Security is the third rail of our political economy. No one wants to touch it. And right now, from time to time, we hear about the Social Security is either bankrupt in the economy, need to raise the retirement age. Help us bring some light into this whole issue.
Yeah, I think this is a really important issue. And I think President Obama appointed a deficit reduction committee. There's a real deficit hysteria. We've got to cut spending. Ironically, instead of our movement stepping into the breach and saying, look, we've got to start taking over and restructuring, you know, the way the banking system works and a major green infrastructure campaign and labor law reform and dropping free trade agreements and really retooling, we got defeated. And now I think conservative forces are really pushing ahead to now start slashing our programs and move us further back. And this is where the Social Security issue comes in. Obama's appointed a commission. The two heads of the commission that are supposed to report after the midterm election are both advocates of cutting Social Security benefits and even privatizing. Social Security is not in crisis. And I think one of the most important things to realize is you can't trust what you're reading because it's distorted and manipulative news that's driven by a real class politics. And so let me give you an example. This year, for the first time Social Security is paying out more to people than it's taking in from payroll taxes. So everyone is saying, oh, the system is heading to be broke. Well, the fact is that the system has generated a huge surplus. We have about $2.5 trillion in a Social Security trust fund. When Social Security was taking in more money than it paid out, it took that money and put it by law into Treasury bills. And those earn interest for the system. So the system has a huge $2.4 trillion savings account. That account earns huge interest every year. And so even though some of that interest had to be used this year to pay Social Security, the interest payments were still great enough that another $100 billion went back into the trust fund. And the Social Security trust fund accountants said, are predicting that this trust fund will grow from $2.5 trillion now to about $3.8 trillion in 2020. And the reason that we had such a shortfall this year is because of the massive unemployment, the serious economic problems. Now, the estimates are that in 2037, the system will finally go through its savings because the baby boom generation will retire. They'll draw lots of money. The new generation of workers won't be as many. And so we'll have to run through that. And in 2037, the system will not be able to pay all of its constituted benefits. First thing to say is even if that's the case, it will still pay about 90% of its benefits. So it's not like it goes bankrupt. But the critical thing is that this estimate of the collapse in, or the you know inability to pay all of its benefits in 2037 is based on assumptions. Mm-hmm. And those assumptions are decided on by these trustees who are political appointees. They are assuming that the U.S. economy will grow over the next 40 years at a rate of about 2%, when over the past, from 1890 to 2007, the economy has grown 3.8%. Mm. They are assuming a rate of per capita income growth of about 1.5% when it's been 2.1%. If you put in a reasonable rate of growth, the system does not go into shortfall. So they are assuming, and why are they assuming that? They're assuming that population growth will almost slow to nothing, that labor force growth will almost slow to nothing, that productivity will be about one-third of what it's been historically, and they don't explain why they make these assumptions. So what they're saying is if the U.S. economy performs about like it did during the Depression era of the 1930s, we may have trouble. But if that's the case, that's a statement that the U.S. economy is in serious trouble, not Social Security. Beyond that, even if you accept the numbers, the Wall Street Journal itself has admitted that if we remove the cap on Social Security taxes, there's no trouble. Now, what do I mean by that? Right now, Social Security is only funded by payroll taxes, and there's a limit of $106,800. If you earn more than that, you pay no Social Security taxes. Because of inequality, more and more of our income is going to people who make more than that. If you remove the cap, take in more money, Social Security, even according to those conservative assumptions, is perfectly fine. So here we have a system that's working well, that even in most dire predictions is going to be fine for the next 37 years. And we all know what forecasting is like. There is no crisis here. This is a politically motivated move to force us to abandon Social Security, to privatize it as a way of propping up the stock market. And because what would happen if you privatize it is you let the private financial interests control the investment. They make money from the government on the investment decisions, and those who own stocks make money because trillions of dollars will be invested in the stock market. This is an attempt to essentially push back and continue the privatization push that's unfounded.
Well, you anticipated my question, because if Social Security is secure, then why is there this movement? And you answered that it's a political class movement in terms of restructuring or structuring the economy and their benefits. So often, though, we hear from some political commentators that, you know, you advocating class warfare. And what I hear from you, there is a class warfare,
yes,
but it's not.
It's unfortunately, it's one-sided. Uh-huh. They're the only side that's engaging in the warfare.
Well, we're discussing this morning our economy with Dr. Martin Landsberg, and we have a caller here who wished to dialogue with you.
Great.
Great. Good morning.
Hi, folks. I'm a member of KVU and encourage all listeners to get in and help us out. And my comments are, thank you very much for having the show. And I heard at first, and you may have already covered this, that nobody wants to touch Social Security. And I know, Doctor, you've been over this. But, hey, this is class warfare. Those Republicans want to take the money from Social Security and give it to Wall Street. And look what they've done to us historically with the that scum Bush Cheney in there, and Republicans had power. They ran up probably $10 to $20 trillion worth of debt, stole a lot of it, and this is class warfare big time, and we're losing, and we better get out and vote and fight. Otherwise, they will, if they get in power, they will take Social Security away. And I tell people this, hey, can you imagine no Social Security in this country? Hey, we'd have cardboard boxes and et cetera all over Yuppie Town, downtown Portland. And so thanks for listening. But we got to remember, we are in a war with the upper class who wants more and more wealth. And another thing, you may have covered this, is FICA. We don't... if someone makes over 108 grand, is the way I understand it, they quit paying FICA. And, it's a regressive tax on working people. And they need to raise the Social Security FICA to higher income levels. As far as I'm concerned, they could do it for the whole income. And thank you very much for listening, and keep up the great work.
Hey, thank you.
Just as a quick response, I certainly agree with the caller that we have to draw a line. And I think part of the problem here, though, is that it's not just Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
Obama has appointed this commission. President Obama, has joined with the previous administration in defending, pursuing the bailouts and supporting maintaining the large banks. I'm not saying there's no difference between the two, but the differences are narrowed by the structural logic here.
Mm-hmm.
And what we have to do is develop the capacity to say, to understand that Social Security is not in crisis, that economists who are being appointed by whether it's Republicans or Democrats are giving us outcomes based on manipulated estimates, that the system can be fixed easily by acknowledging the inequality. So what's required is that we have the confidence to say, we're not going to accept this. And it's not just a matter of voting for Democrats or Republicans, because there are leaders in both parties who are sort of pursuing the same line. And so, I'm not saying, don't vote, but what I'm saying is if we don't build a movement that's clear about what we need and can pressure governments and put on the table challenges to this, we're in big trouble. And let me just give you another example, and that's the free trade agreements.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, President Obama is calling for the signing to ratify the free trade agreement with Korea, one with Colombia, one with Panama. These were signed by the previous administration but not ratified by Congress. A lot of talk in the newspaper about this free trade agreement. What will happen to our auto sector, our beef sector? The fact is that these free trade agreements, they're called trade because people think, maybe free trade is good. And so just like with NAFTA, where it says North American Free Trade or the World Trade Organization, trade, there's much more involved here. These agreements, like with the Korea agreement, are designed with many chapters, many parts that are all designed to restrict governments, to enhance the power of corporations. So, for example, the U.S.-Korea Free Trade Agreement limits government's ability to regulate speculative capital. It limits government's ability to spend money to hire companies based on their labor and environmental record. It says only non-economic criteria cannot be used in purchases. So if I say, this company is good in labor or good environment or it hires local people, that decision can be challenged under the free trade agreement by other corporations who say, we can deliver a lower price because we exploit our workers or we exploit the environment. This free trade agreement is an attempt basically to bust South Korea's public health care system, and it would make it harder for us to have a public health care system. We don't even get this news. This is what I mean by a class project. These free trade agreements are about opening up and weakening the ability of the public through its bodies to regulate economic activity. We don't get the news. We have to be prepared, we have to learn, we have to talk, and we have to build our understanding. So whenever we hear something is designed to free up capital, to free up markets, we have to say, not good, not good. And so then we have to start to think, how do we build our understandings and our power to begin to re-regulate, cancel the free trade agreements, to withdraw from the WTO, to pass labor law reform, to build an industrial policy that will restructure the economy.
So it's just not just tinkering around the edges, it's fundamental restructuring that is required. And we are continuing our conversation with Dr. Martin Hart Landsberg. We're talking about our economy, what we can do to improve it. As we continue our conversation, have with us Dr. Martin Hart Landsberg, professor of economics at Lewis and Clark College in Portland, Oregon. Continuing our conversation, we know what the problems are, but we also have the ability to solve these problems and some solutions. One thing that we need to know is how to organize. One time, labor unions were a very powerful movement. They seem to have collapsed. What can we do to empower workers?
Well, it's a critical question, a big one, but I think that's where we need to sort of reconceive of how our various community institutions work. there's plenty to talk about. Right now, people, you know, read the papers. They listen, even if they try and be informed, and they get confused by the way the free trade agreement is presented, the way Social Security crisis is presented. So what we need to do is say, you know, how do we make union meetings places where working people can come and talk and learn? Mm-hmm. People are hungry to go to libraries, to go to their, you know, to their places of, you know, of worship, to whatever. And those, you know, I mean, those should be places where these problems are openly discussed, and people are given an opportunity to develop their understandings and to begin to have confidence in alternatives. I mean, yeah. As you said, there, you know, right now, there are plenty of things that we could be resisting and fighting as a way of going from defense to offense. I mean, we should be building movements that say we reject the free trade agreement, not because, you know, General Motors, who already builds 900,000 cars in South Korea, can't get as good a deal as it wants, but because this free trade agreement will structurally limit our ability to ever regulate financial industries, create public health, and we want these things. How do we build that understanding and that movement? How do we say we need the Employee Free Choice Act to strengthen unions? How do we say, you know, we oppose any cuts in Social Security? How do we say we need more government spending right now? This notion that we're, you know, the government deficit is out of control is not even honestly based on facts. I mean, we get these huge budgets because, for the same reason I mentioned before, inappropriate underlying assumptions about how the economy will perform. We are in a period of economic stagnation. There is nothing that will lead us to conclude that this economy is going to recover and get back on its feet in the given structure. People are deep in debt. Employment is bad. Banks are sitting on over $1 trillion worth of money in the banks that they won't lend out. Non-financial companies have more money, more cash as a percentage of their assets than they ever have had in their history. They're not investing. And now we're expected to cut government. And all that's going to do is drive the economy down further when we already have massive unemployment. So what we need to do is to bring people together in whatever institutions we're in, whether mm-hmm. it's universities, unions, library groups, you know, religious institutions, and say we have to take this seriously and talk and bring our, you know, bring a sense of confidence that yes. just relying on the existing system doesn't work. And at a minimum, resisting all these attempts that will make things worse, like the free trade agreement, the cut in Social Security, the cuts in spending. All of that will make it worse. So stopping that is a step in the right direction. And if in that process we begin to develop an understanding of why we have to stop it,
yes.
then we develop the confidence to start saying, well, what would be the best way to raise taxes on the wealthy? Perhaps public ownership, a state bank, you know, mm-hmm. an end to free trade agreements, regulations. We can see other countries. Other countries have experience at doing these things. We can learn from this history if we begin to develop our capacities to study it and to communicate it.
Excellent. Let's go to our callers online who are waiting to speak with Dr. Martin Hart Landsberg. Good morning, caller.
Good morning, Mr. Landsberg.
Hi.
Hi. Mr. Landsberg, I wanted to say something out loud. Maybe it's perfectly obvious to everyone else, but it seems like we have a very terrible contradiction going on. On the one hand, everyone acknowledges that both political parties have been captured by the forces of Wall Street, whether it's Goldman Sachs or Morgan Stanley. The conventional political wisdom is that in 1972, the Democratic Party ran George McGovern, and supposedly he was so far left that the Democratic Party is never going to make that same mistake again, and so we get Bill Clinton and Barack Obama and so forth. But this contradiction seems to be that on the one hand, we acknowledge that both parties have been captured by Wall Street, and then at the very same time, we turn around and say, well, okay, now we have to build a quote-unquote political movement, when I don't think most people are able to wrap their minds around this unbelievable nightmare that both parties have been captured by the forces of big business. I think that is such a dispiriting notion. Most people don't even, you know, grasp that. And so it's like it's such a contradiction to say, okay, both major parties have been taken over, but we need to form a political movement. It's like, yay, let's all jump on board and try to take on both major political parties.
Well, when I'm saying about a political movement, though, I mean around issues. In other words, right now we have working people who don't have clarity about whether government spending is too great or deficits are too great, about whether Social Security is in crisis, whether free trade agreements are good or not. And so what I'm suggesting is that our task is not primarily an electoral task, although voting is important, but it's building a clear understanding about political interest and to build community strength to put those interests onto the political agenda. In other words, imagine if in 5 years we build a political movement with people who can put on the public agenda the need for strong regulations, for public ownership, for a different kind of economy. And imagine if 5 years after that, we have a political party that can actually put those kinds of interests up into the political arena for real debate. We begin to shift things. Right now, our task is that people don't have a belief in an alternative, or they're fooled by what they hear, and so they don't think there's an alternative. And so when they vote, a political movement doesn't have much meaning in and of itself. What we need to do is, when I say political movement, I mean a movement of people who have come together, who understand why this is stagnation, why the structure is bad, why relying on the same processes will not help us, even though it continues to generate profits, and how that then, you know, how then we want to use that political strength to influence the quote-unquote formal political process becomes very different.
But you would acknowledge, though, wouldn't you, Dr. Landsberg, that the average person who is so overworked and trying to take care of their family and so forth, they still have this perception that one of the major parties is quote-unquote on their side. And so they, when they think of, you know, being part of a political movement, they think, oh, well, I'm going to vote for the Democratic Party. Well, they haven't even grasped
that
both parties have been completely captured by Wall Street.
But our responsibility then is to do good political education. I think people are hungry to understand things. Mm-hmm. They don't have a place when they read the press or they watch the news, they don't get anything that empowers them. They get that there is no choice.
Right.
And so what we need to do is create that space where people feel comfortable coming, talking, learning, and that means investing in our institutions.
Excellent. Oh, thank you, caller.
Thank you. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you for raising those very important points. And we'll go to our next caller. Good morning, caller.
Yes. This really does follow up on that previous conversation. I have two points. One, to point out a huge problem that I think we're facing and that has been increasing, and the economic situation shows it perfectly, that our society and Western society generally, but stick with America, has built itself up into such a complex situation that the complexity is so deep and the numbers are so huge, mm-hmm. both in the population, the structure, all the bureaucracies, all the elements involved, the amounts of money are so gigantic that the human mind, no human mind can grasp what $1 trillion is. You know, it's impossible. And so we've gotten ourselves into a situation historically, and it's taken, you know, centuries to get here, and technology is just really making it more possible to be what I call it in over our heads. And that includes, unfortunately, you know, the professor's job is to try and grasp all this complexity as a full-time job, right? That's what economists do. Yeah. Good luck, professor. Anyway.
Thank you, caller. We're running out of time.
Well, let me make a quick point then, because the last call, I'm going to make a very extreme suggestion for a possible solution, because I think the complexity is way too much for the human mind at this point.
And your proposal?
So my proposal is, remember that the Europeans came over to America to the woods and started a new society. Then after a while, they had about 3 million people, and people started to come west into open land, and they started new societies
on a simple
basis.
I think there's I appreciate what you're saying about complexity, but here's the thing. When capitalists want a free trade agreement that will keep the government from doing anything, they hire lawyers to work out the particular language that's complex. But their vision of what they want, make sure that no public health care system stands, mm-hmm. is very clear. The same for us. Yes, there is a complexity about how to organize certain things. But it's not a complex question to say when a system doesn't work for you.
Right.
And that's what we have to develop the confidence in, whether it's, you know, thinking about the war spending, thinking about the priorities. We have to develop a way of seeing how those things fit together and have historically not worked for us. That isn't complex. Once we begin to clarify, you know, the kinds of directions we want to go, sure, complexities enter. The other side has the same problem. We don't have the unity because of our numbers and our divisions and how we get pitted against each other at this point to come together to shape that clarity. That's our challenge.
That's a challenge. And I really appreciate you sharing this morning. I'm not only laying out the issues, but showing us how to get to solutions and how to build an economy and society. We've been speaking this morning with Dr. Martin Hart Landsberg, professor of economics at Lewis and Clark, and, you know, former Brooklyn Dodgers fan. Hey, but thank you for giving us hope and for inspiring us this morning.